All right. Hello, and welcome to a joint venture of Real Seekers and the Faith Unaltered podcast. I'm Dale, the Real Seeker, and I'm joined by my co-host, Tyler. How's it going, Tyler?
What's up, Dale? Yeah, just got off work, man, so pulled an all-nighter, and I'm ready to have a good conversation. This is going to be fun, I think.
Awesome. Yeah. And basically today's show, believe it or not, I'm joined with a special guest who reached out to me to speak about their expertise as a psychic. So Barbara Wythe. Hey, Barbara, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Dale. Hi, Tyler. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. And I just want to, before we get into kind of evaluating your worldview and claims and stuff like that, I just wanted you to take a couple of minutes to kind of introduce the audience as to who you are, share a little bit about your background, and if you're comfortable doing so, maybe a little about your faith or religious faith or irreligious faith, whatever it is, your journey.
Sure. Well, I always start as far as being a psychic with my music. Because I started very, very early. In fact, my mother was the church choir director. And I grew up EUB. I don't even know if that's around anymore. Evangelical United Brethren. Okay. And she pulled me into the choir and I started playing piano. And I started writing songs when I was 12 or 13. And that process is really what set me up then to become a psychic channel, to do the kind of channeling that I do with those in afterlife today, because it's kind of the same process. But when I was in high school, I started seeing a friend of mine's mother. She was a channel, we didn't call them that. And she said she was just like a giant antenna picking up my higher power. And a lot of those messages she gave me were really about self-love and self-care. It wasn't so much about going to find out if my boyfriend was going to come back, although I'm sure I asked those kinds of questions, but it was really guiding me in the direction of self-awareness. And I went to her for many years. I became a professional musician. And in 1987, I came in off the road. I'd been on the road for about 15 years, and it was, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and I was completely burnt out. And I started to automatic write spontaneously one day when I was writing a letter. So I knew what it was, but I was still very surprised at what was happening. And when I asked, "Who are you?" they said, "Sound." And I guess because I was a musician and working with sound, if either of you are a musician and your listeners out there are songwriters or even players, there's a kind of a channeling that you do, like when a sax player is doing a solo. It's the same sort of process. So I was okay with that. And then I started to become a reader, like my mentor had been. And in 1993, I started to do group channeling because I wanted to know what would this say to a group of people. Mm-hmm. And I found two women, Teresa McMillan and Kimberly Phelps, and we became the Psychic Sorority, and we started holding group channeling. We would record them, transcribe them. And when they asked, "Who are you?" they said, "You can call us angels." And I am a very healthy skeptic, just in case anybody wonders. This was all very new to me, and I was very skeptical, but the three of us talked about it and said, the information that they were giving us was changing our lives so profoundly for the better, teaching us how to self-love, that we really didn't care if they were angels or the Easter Bunny. We were getting these results that were so remarkable. And these angels said they had this process that they theoretically felt would be the answer to what they called world peace, one person at a time, starting with self. And it was this revolutionary way to resolve conflict first and foremost within yourself. And they needed people to test it. And you couldn't like pretend to have a conflict to see if it worked. They had to actually insert it into. And so there we were, the three of us. And when we had our first conflict, we actually got the transcripts and did it the different way and had just remarkable results. And so I did that for a long time. We published our first book in 1997, Diaries of a Psychic Sorority. And it was from there that I learned through that process that I could also communicate with people who had passed on, but I was doing work also with people who were in Alzheimer's comas and autistic people and their parents. So this intuitive art was serving me in many ways. And in 1998, I put out a book called Party of 12, The Afterlife Interviews. And it was the result of Diaries of a Psychic Sorority catching the interest of a British tabloid that was looking for an interview with Princess Diana on a one-year anniversary of her death. And I, again, skeptical, I thought, what? Let's see what happened. And it was so profound. They flew me out to New York, spent 5 hours with me, but they didn't want the interview. So my agent and I went on to ask others in the afterlife if there's more famous people. And after several, we did Nicole Brown Simpson, and that was mind-boggling. And we got to John Kennedy, and he said, we have been working on this in afterlife, so we're going to tell you who's coming up to talk to you. And the next one was Albert Einstein. And when I channeled Albert Einstein, the familiarity with that energy was so profound. It was the voice of my channeling. It was the voice of sound. It was an energy that had been with me since I started doing music. And he was also, now I wasn't a big Einstein fan. I mean, who doesn't love Einstein in real life? But I wasn't like a science, all I ever wanted to be was a rock star. So this was all very new to me. But in 2005, I thought I'm going to do a little volume just for him. And it was the 100-year anniversary of his miracle year. So I channeled 6-7 sessions and I sat down to edit. And what happened was, and this was really took me a long time to come to terms with the reality of this, because it sounds, I mean, I can throw it off now, but he said he was here to deliver to me a unified field theory, which was something that he couldn't do in real life. Maps of human consciousness, which were going to be his theoretical proof that our interaction as humans with energy affects what manifests around us. Mm-hmm. And then, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we will be asking you a little bit more about those in detail as well later on in the list. But yeah, go ahead and finish your intro.
And then he gave us a scientific quantifiable definition of compassion, and as the fifth fundamental force of the universe. So that's kind of in a nutshell, a pretty crazy experience that I've had. But I started training conflict revolution, which is what we called what they taught us, probably in 1999. And I've been training it ever since. And this unified field theory that he gave us, which we can talk about later, has really proven to be monumental and phenomenal. And so I'm out on the road now getting feedback. I'm looking to present this to scientists and psychologists and all kinds of other people. Because when my book, Imagining Einstein, came out in 2007, I was invited all over the world. So I was teaching and training and showing the unified field to all kinds of people and getting all kinds of feedback. And this April, I've been invited to speak at the Science of Consciousness Conference at the University of Tucson. Oh, and nice. I'm very excited because that's going to be my chance to be in front of real scientists and then student scientists and science to see what that feedback is.
Having that peer review there. So, all right, cool. One thing, just a quick follow-up before I go to Tyler for question two. You mentioned you were part of the Evangelical United Brethren. I've never heard of that denomination. Do you know, like, what do they kind of believe? What makes them distinct from other, do you know?
I'm thinking back because I think it was fairly United Brethren. I think it was just fairly, to me, it was fairly generic Lutheran type of, and not that I know, you know, the difference between all sorts of different denominations, but it was, to me, it was just fairly generic.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So yeah, now that we've kind of gotten the intro, we know who you are, where you're coming from. Tyler, I'll give it over to you to ask the next question. It would help if we could hear you, but
yeah, my mic cable is going out, and so I've got to get a new one of those. So my apologies on that. Before I go to question two, I do have a follow-up question to your intro, Barbara. Have you published any peer-reviewed material in the past about this subject, specifically the unified field theory? And if not, is that what you're doing now while you're on this tour to get peer-reviewed documentation?
I have not had peer review, and I'm feeling like this Arizona presentation is going to get me at least in the presence of people who understand what peer review is, because
right. This
is total like blue ocean for me. I'm probably going to be the only one there who is a psychic who claims that Albert Einstein gave them the unified field. So I'm hoping to see that, but more than that, my world tour is about using conflict revolution. I'm looking for the participation of the willing, who are willing to start with themselves as a pathway to global peace.
Sure, sure. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Also, I'm curious. So I'm very interested in paranormal activities and unexplained natural phenomena, or even supernatural phenomena in those instances. And so I'm really curious. So you've used a couple adjectives to describe your introduction and your experience with these things, namely profound, mind-boggling, and you've had good results. Can you elaborate on those? I know you talked about the Albert Einstein giving you this unified field theory, but whenever you talk to, I think you said Anna Nicole, is that right?
Nicole Brown Simpson.
Nicole Simpson, that's yes. Right. And all the other individuals that you've talked to, can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by profound and mind-boggling?
For me, it was profound because, first of all, this was a completely new experience that I had no idea what was going to happen.
Sure.
So when she came up, my idea was that when you die and you go into afterlife, because life is eternal for me, that you get to this place of peace and loving and unity and everything you hear maybe from near-death experiences and stuff. She was not even close. And it really opened my eyes up to that there was this greater process of transformation after we leave our bodies. It just isn't, you know, you're just not suddenly in a place of peace, especially if you, I think when you leave the planet emotionally attached to something or someone, you take that attachment into the afterlife with you. And then I think that's why there's so many people that reincarnate together, right? Because they die still loving their children. And so there's this attachment that comes to sort of recreate that. But that was very profound, what she said, as she described, I don't know what you'd call it. Is it reverse racism? Is it just plain old racism of how OJ was raised? What were the influences of him from the culture that he grew up in? What he was taught by with that, and the complexities of him maneuvering through the world as a person of color who also knew he had to excel in the white man's world, so to speak. So those were the kinds of profound information that I was getting from these people that I really didn't know much about any of these people.
Did she say OJ did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Right on. No, fair enough. Now one last follow-up and I'll go to question two. I'm sorry. I love this. This is interesting to me. So you described the afterlife a little bit or mentioned it. Would you say that the afterlife is still within, if we could even describe it like that, within this universe, or are we talking like different dimensions of reality, of space-time? How would you describe that?
Well, and that's where the maps that we created, the unified field maps and the maps of human consciousness, explain this afterlife, because what the maps do is they show us step by step how the physical world is created. And when you go through them and you realize that there is this lens. He calls it the lens of the physical world, where we're all sitting, right? We're separate. You're there in Indiana, I'm here in the UK.
Right.
But at our root, we're all sourced together, and the process of separating ourselves begins in that root, and it's projected up this gravitational wave that then creates this lens of the physical world. And what Einstein says, and by the way, the source, he says, is actually literally in the center of the earth. Mm. That is where all life begins, where the mystery is, where the void, everything and nothing. And so as that gravitational wave is flowing up to the surface of the planet and creates this lens for us to have this physical experience in our bodies, are the projectors and the perceivers of that world. When we lose our body, that gravitational wave, which is spinning like a string back up through the North Pole, it keeps going. We just don't have the physical body that then allows us to have the physical experience, the separation. So in that sense, afterlife, and they've told us this forever, is that there's a part of you that's dead already. There's a part of you that exists in what is afterlife. And when you lose that body, that string that's spinning, it mm-hmm. slows down to create the lens to the speed of light. And when you lose your body, it speeds back up to the speed of light squared. And all of the, he calls it a compilation of consciousness, because we compile mathematics all through our life. Every time we turn right, a certain set of circumstances, we turn left, a different set, and all that compiles in our compilation, so that when the body dies, all of that mathematics is still there. And it becomes sort of that holographic idea that we have of, this whole idea I'm loving lately, do we live in a simulation? That's the new sort of
idealism. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this actually shows you that we do. And here's how it's constructed, and here's how we can influence it and what manifests in that lens.
Interesting. All right. Go ahead, Del.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. I was just going to say, like, I think you've answered half of question two already. You've kind of hinted at what the afterlife entails. And you, one thing that you mentioned that I picked up on was near death experiences. And you said that you see that as kind of supporting evidence for the afterlife and stuff like that. I'm just kind of curious, like, what do you make? Because there is conflicting experiences, right? Like, people have different types of near-death experiences. So what do you make of that? And how would that cohere with your model of what the afterlife consists of?
So what we've been told is that what you are conceiving is going to be afterlife while you're alive. You have this imagination. Maybe you think you're going in a hole in the ground. Maybe you think you're going to be with all the Vestal Virgins. Maybe you think you're going up to a cloud. He says that imprint and those mathematics of expectation you take with you when you first don't have a body. And there's this adaptation period of adapting to the fact that you no longer have this activity of creating the body in the physical world, and you're in this pure energy form. And what you believe will first manifest. So those people who believe that they're going in a hole in the ground will be through a period of sort of unconsciousness until the energy kicks back in to begin to inform that soul of what really truthfully is. So you think you're going to see Jesus. Jesus is coming for you. You think you're going to, like I said, see those Vestal Virgins. But ultimately, now in the case of the Vestal Virgins, I was referring to the, and I remember the 9/11 attacks, right. The guys who drove they were martyrs, and they figured we're going to die, but we're going to be with the Vestal Virgins for a while, until energy and whatever you've compiled in that compilation starts to really inform and be revealed in that state. And then you have to deal with, I guess you might call it karma, but it's the mathematics of your choices in life.
So would you describe that initial process, like, of the person who thinks they're going to see Jesus, seeing Jesus and the Vestal Virgin Muslims and seeing that. Would you describe that as an illusion?
I think it's a construct. It's an illusion, like everything is an illusion. You know, I'm constructing this computer right now with my interaction with this energy. But when I lose my body, computer isn't going to be here. Mm. So I think it's more of that energetic construct that we come in to afterlife with, that then just like life, we come in with so much, you know, pre-programmed personality and perspectives that then life informs us as we go along and learn this and that. So that's what I believe that.
Okay. All right. Dale, did you want to go ahead and tackle the second or the first half of question two, or did you want me to do
that? So I'll tackle that, and then you can do question three.
Perfect.
The existence of God, as traditionally understood, what's your take on, you know, do you think that a God exists in your model, or is it more of a pantheistic model? What's your view on that front?
Well, what Einstein said was compassion is the fifth fundamental force of the universe. He describes it as the intelligence that uses the four fundamental forces to impel the creation of the universe one step at a time. And he uses compassion for several reasons. One is that if you know anything about science, the four fundamental forces, electromagnetics, gravity, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, they all have something that they do. Electromagnetics sort of ignite things and gravity guides things. So the fifth fundamental force is the intelligence that organizes this in this incredibly mysterious way. And of course, profound, the mind of God, you can't even begin to explain. And it does three things to energy using the four fundamental forces. The first thing is like a compass that draws circles. So it impels energy to step out of nothing and into something and create this spherical electromagnetic domain that's going to surround all of the mathematics that are going to be you. And I have mine and you have yours. And the second thing it does, a compass that heads us to the north, it aligns us all to the earth so that we're all on the same map. And the third thing it does, it instills in that compilation the truth of the oneness of who we actually are. And I think that's probably more the classical definition of what God might be. But what I love about this definition is that he was going for the unified field theory. And if you're talking about unifying all religions, everybody has a different name for it. But at the root of really true religion that lifts us up and connects us to this greater sense of purpose is compassion. So it kind of covers everything, every religion, and it gets down to the root of what that God function really is.
Gotcha. All right, cool. Tyler, over to you for question three.
Barbara, take some time to describe what being a psychic means and a little about the channeling process in general. How does it work? Can you talk to anyone anytime about any subject or limitations, etc.? And how did you get started channeling? And what are some of your most memorable experiences? It sounds like the Albert Einstein experience is the one that has impacted you the most. I'm just assuming that. Correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I like to take the model of the unified field theory. Within that structure, there's what we call three human dimensions. And these are three dimensions that we all have, that we all function just like we have a heart and intestines and kidneys, and they all have different forms, but they function together. The three human dimensions are emotion, intuition, and intellect. And they all have their own form of what they are, and they're a little different than what you might naturally think those things are.
Yeah.
But intuition is a part of every single human being. It's just like everybody has to have a heart or you don't live. So everybody has intuition. Everybody has intellect. Everybody has emotion. But intellect, which is really in charge of defining things, has defined us as, you know, people are always telling me, oh, I wish I had intuition. It's like you do. So right. There's a way that these three things function together in order to be what we call aligned to compassion. And for me, channeling is about going into the nothing and listening and being able to discern what that information is. So, for example, I started with music, where I always described when I was very young that I was going into outer space and I was listening for the song that was already written. And then I'd bring back the first four bars and I'd have to interpret, right? The melody, the chords, the words. And then I'd play that until the next four bars would come out because I'd be listening.
Right.
And I think with channeling, it's very difficult to really pin down one way or another that it's supposed to happen. I think everybody has, just like there's numbers of artists and musicians, everybody has their own way that they deal with the intuitive arts that they have. I know people who can pick up a ring, your ring, and tell you all about your childhood. Mm-hmm. I have been predictive, but for the most part, the work that I was pulled into was far more focused on leading me up to be able to deliver this unified field and these maps of human consciousness and conflict revolution than it was to be on the psychic hotline telling you if you're going to get that job next week.
Right.
So, and why that is, I'm not really sure.
Just out of curiosity, what compelled you to trust these entities, individuals that speak to you? Was there something that stands out to you as a single instance or event that caused you to trust these people, Einstein in particular?
Well, I think it started with my mentor, because I was probably 16 when I went to my first reading with Mike's mom, Eunice, and she always had a candle lit, and she had this beautiful picture of Jesus behind her. And she never remembered anything, but everything that she said to me just resonated so deeply in me that I was so moved to tears. And she would talk to me like she was inside my head, reading my mind, understanding and guiding me into more loving and self-loving places. And so that established a trust in that process. And then when I started doing it, trust me, I was put through a training program of sorts to sure. where in the beginning,
boot camp.
Yeah, you're right. You can imagine you get all heady, like, oh, I'm going to channel. And, you know, I had my knockdowns. And then what I did with her was I would write down, you had to take notes because that was before we had portable tape recorders. And then I would write down what I thought it meant. And then I would live life and then see what it actually meant against what I thought it meant, against what was said. And so I really did some in-depth study, not just believing stuff. So by the time the angels came and I had these two women and so many miraculous things were happening and we were together, right? You couldn't be like, it couldn't just be me and my ego. They yep. were there to bring that around. And so by the time I got to Einstein and the party and all of that, honestly, it took me a long time to really come to a place where I could say with surety that I'm talking to Einstein. And even after I wrote the first book, I was sort of like, well, you know, you don't have to believe it's really Einstein, but look at what it says because it's so profound. It's worth Einstein. And I did this big event in 2007 where it was broadcast to like 500,000 people around the world. And there was 2,000 people in the auditorium. And they came up to me afterwards, you know, wagging their finger at me. Don't you say this isn't Einstein, because this is Einstein. And I was like, okay.
call it Einstein. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so one last follow-up, and then Dale, I'll hand it over to you. So now let's go back, and because I think that this interests me so much, obviously I'm a Christian. I'm just converted to from Protestantism to Eastern Orthodoxy. And so mysticism is a very, I'll put it, it's a very high priority subject that I'm currently studying at the time. And you definitely piqued my interest, Barbara. I'm not going to lie to you. And so you said that, and correct me if I'm wrong on this because I didn't get it wrote down exactly, but did you say that the, before Einstein, the angels, did you say that they self-identified as angels to you, or that's what you called them?
That's what they said.
Okay. They identified. Okay, good. Do you also believe in demons, or has demons ever tried to attempt to contact you?
You know, I haven't had experience with demons in the sense of the antithesis of angels. Mm-hmm. I have, however, had an extensive experience with people who may be driven by demonic energy.
So psychopaths, possessed.
Yeah. I mean, I've been sexually assaulted, and I've been,
I'm sorry to hear that.
So what I always, when people say to me, you know, well, how do you know you're not channeling demons? Because, you know, sure, they'll come in the face of, I truly believe that God, that compassion, that truth, real truth that embodies compassion, which means we are all one. I think truth is its own definition. That somebody can come to you and say, just in real life, and not even after, you know, in energy, hey, I'm going to do some great things for you. And it'll be a matter of time before the truth comes out. And if the three of us, when we were originally talking about, well, what do you mean these are angels?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but except that what they were saying was so divine, and it was revealing itself to be transformational to our lives, to where we were learning how to love ourselves. I mean, that was revolutionary and profound for me, coming sure out of the kind of background that I had. So yeah, it's a good question. And people always ask it, well, we're told in the Bible that, you know, the demons will pose as angels. And I said, yeah, I bet they will. But if you really have faith and you really know God within yourself, that is the greatest defense against demonic forces. Or even, you know, I always say that it's just as dangerous walking around the streets of most cities in the United States these days than going into afterlife and, you know, being confronted by demons.
Right. All right. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Dale.
Okay. I think we have one good kind of clarifying question from the audience just on what your view is. And this numeric is asking, is your worldview kind of like that movie, What Dreams May Come, with Robin Williams? I haven't seen the movie, so I have no idea, but
neither have I.
Well, I think sort of there's some truth to that movie. I have a tendency to want to always side on the sense of mystery, that at the root of everything, as Einstein has told us, and also Edward Witten, who was the scientist who created M theory, is that at the root of everything, and I think most scientists will tell you this true, it's a mystery. It is a mystery. And so this humility to be able to accept that there, you know, God is such a mystery that we can't claim to know, we can suppose. And so I liked that movie because I liked the idea that there was an afterlife that wasn't just on the clouds, and that there was an interaction in it. I don't know, you know, probably, I won't spoil anything to say Robin Williams had to go into hell, okay, to go get his wife who had committed suicide. And I love that part of it. The rest of it where, you know, his kids in real life showed up as completely different, right? His daughter, I believe, was, I can't, don't quote me on that, but I thought his daughter came back as a black man or was in afterlife as a black man, and he didn't recognize his son or whatever, because there was, I don't know about that, but I really liked that part of that movie, that that life goes on in such a creative and informing way.
Gotcha. Okay. So I think we've kind of covered it. The fourth question here on the last of my questions on kind of like getting to know what your views are and stuff is kind of just going over the unified field theory, maps of human consciousness, and the science of compassion. I know you've been speaking a lot about that. Is there anything that you've haven't discussed yet that you think we need to know in order to understand those theories there?
Well, I think the simplicity of the system that I've talked about, for example, that we all have these three human dimensions and that we all have the ability to witness ourselves and to learn what it is we're thinking, what it is we're feeling, what our heart and the voice of God is intuiting us to say or to do, because intuition is always the voice of God telling us the next step for the good of the whole situation, whatever that situation is, and that we can, as humans, get control of those three human dimensions, especially the intellect, which we all know can do the greatest damage in this being told. And I happen to think that it's the human intellect that gets taken over by that dark energy that then drives the whole system into a sort of demonic type of response system. So I think it's really, really encouraging and important for people to know that they have that power to master themselves in a way that aligns them to God, especially if now you guys have some really strong faith and a lot of people don't. I was driven from the church by some pretty horrific stuff. And so I found that this philosophy is, it's kind of the perfect cross between religion and science. And in fact, I had a client tell me that for years, her and her husband could not, they were total opposites when it came to faith. He was over there, she was over there. They read the book and they found that middle ground where they could have a faith in God as compassion, but also a scientific understanding of how things work and how we have this power over our own lives to make, to align to compassion and be led by that voice of God within.
All right. Cool. So here, another question, I think it might be appropriate at this part, but basically on Albert Einstein. Okay. Where is it? Okay. So he says this, when Einstein told Bergson there was no time of the philosophers, what did he mean by that? Did he understand the distinction between psychology and physics, in your view? And I have my own follow-up after this, actually.
If you think about the time that Einstein lived, it was a time where psychology was just developing. And in fact, in the Party of 12, my book, we also interviewed Freud. And I did not know anything about Freud and Einstein's real relationship in life. But Freud was bringing forth this idea of psychology, a little off the mark, I think, based on some of his own psychoses. He assumed everybody had them. But they were in the process of developing physics. Albert Einstein completely changed science. Freud completely changed what psychology was then sort of springing out of. That was what they were there to do. So I think it was an exciting time for them. And I think that when Einstein said, you know, he said a lot of things, I think, in life that he doesn't necessarily now agree with. And maybe in afterlife, one of my missions, you know, why am I the one that was chosen and volunteered to be this person that brings this forward? I don't know. But he knew in this world now, we need more philosophers than we necessarily need scientists, because we as people need to come together And you can fight about this religion or that religion or science versus religion. But if we're just into philosophy and philosophizing with mystery at its root, maybe we can have some more intriguing, exciting conversations rather than be constantly fighting each other.
I definitely like that since I'm a philosopher. So yeah. All right. Well, he mentions time about this issue about time. Hold on. Let me hide that. Maybe you've talked to Albert Einstein. Maybe you could actually help, because me and Tyler have actually been having a debate for a while. We actually just did a show with Warren McGrew on the nature of time and stuff. And obviously Albert Einstein, as you said, he revolutionized thing with his theory, the scientific world with the theory of relativity and all that. So me and Tyler have been going back and forth. Tyler thinks that Einstein taught this Minkowskian view, right? Like a B theory, a tenseless theory of time. Whereas I'm saying, no, I think he went for a Neo-Lorentzian or A theory, like where only the present moment exists. Can you help settle our debate there? Or
what? Before you answer that, Barbara, I just want to say this real quick. Dell's wrong, but go ahead.
The best that I can say, because like I said, I'm not well-versed in what you were saying, but okay. What he says is that, and this is this also goes for the speed of light, because everyone's, you know, in science has said, well, you know, you can't go past the speed of light. And yet in the equals MC squared, the speed of light squared, he says that the spinning string that is at the root of who we are is spinning at the speed of light squared. And so when you have what he calls the human intention, this is this triangular sort of geometric figure that slows that string down, the lens sort of drops over that string and slows it down so that we have this separate human experience. In the lens, it's the speed of light. Outside the lens, in the operating system that's creating that simulation, it's the speed of light squared. And I think it's also true of time, is that whatever the rules are, why are the rules? Where did they come from? God? Okay, the mystery. That we move through space-time, that you cannot have space in the lens without having time. And even if you get down to the microcosm with the space between the molecules, you know, time seems to be standing still, but that's the rules of that functioning. However, if you're looking at the whole operating system where it is the speed of light squared, there is this truth also that really all there is this present moment where we're projecting and perceiving. The future is a thought, the past is a thought, but what then is moving? Is time moving, or is it the energy that's transforming, you know, as we age, but we're still in present moment? You're never really in the future, are you? You're never in the past, but it's a construct.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So I'm going to move on to the next question. And this is where I wanted to kind of, Tyler's already gotten into this a bit, but this is kind of, I want to evaluate now some of the claims and stuff like that. So I imagine you've encountered many skeptics and stuff like that. They're, you know, skeptics of all sorts and stuff like that. Now, you claim to have worked with Albert Einstein and coming up with these theories and that sort of thing. Now, I know you're coming up with your conference to kind of get that specifically from scientists and stuff, but from people, from skeptics that you've encountered already, what has been some of the critiques or feedback that you've already received in terms of your models and stuff?
I have presented this for years. Since 2007, when I left to tour the world and show the unified field theories and the maps of human consciousness to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And so far, the conversations and the feedback that I get are, I'm going to say, energized. So here's an example. I was booked into what was called a metaphysical meetup. You know, meetup, they're an online app, but you meet in person.
Yeah.
And so I thought metaphysical, you know, woo woo, angels. No, it was amateur physicists, amateur chemists, amateur scientists who got together every week to talk about the latest theories in science. And I walked in and I was a little mortified because I don't know anything about science. I don't. I, like I said, all I ever wanted to be was a rock star, but apparently, you know, I have this gift. So after a while, sitting uncomfortably, somebody was like, let her talk. And I got up and I said, okay, here's the deal. I am not a scientist. I talk to dead people. I think I talked to Albert Einstein. So I'm not here to convince you of that. But would you please tell me what you think of this? Because I don't know. I'm not a scientist. When I was writing the book and he said that the source is in the center of the earth and it's a black hole, I was mortified. I said, I have to go out into the world and tell people this. I don't even know if that's even feasibly possible. Now I'm learning that it absolutely is. But so their responses were off the charts. The physicist was like, wait a minute, you've taken the zero point gravity theory and you've married it with the blah, 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 and you put in the blah, 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 right? And I was like, I don't know. Did I? It's like, is that
you tell me?
Yeah. And the chemist was like, the old model was there were six somethings that then fall into each. And what you're saying is there's nine actually. And I'm like, yeah. So that's the only kind of responses that I've ever got from anyone. No one said, hey, listen, this can't be. That's a bunch of bunk. People are just absolutely fascinated and it gets them thinking. And I have to tell you, lately, I've been doing tons of podcasts with probably less any kind of formalized religion or scientific focus, just a lot of people wanting to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. People just, they're, it right now, boom, 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 and it sparks open there. It's like, wow, that, whoa, yes, yes. And that's what I think it's supposed to do. Rather than to be the, like, I have the answer. It's like, let's inform you, see it, see what you think of it, see how it turns your perspective of what you know to maybe a little, oh yeah, more unifying, kind of a higher understanding of things. And he always said the reason that he didn't do this mathematically was because this was the time where we had to talk more in parable. We had to talk in understanding with pictures so that everybody can understand it and not just informed scientists.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, Tyler, do you have any follow-ups on that or do you want to move on to question six? Because there are skeptics, not just our materialists. There are also religious skeptics. But yeah, Tyler, do you have any follow-ups on the...
Dale... Listen to me, brother. I can take this direction a million different ways if you want me to. So first and foremost, I just want to say as a Christian, and I'm sure Dale feels the same way too, even though he hasn't said it yet. Whenever I hear you, Barbara, say that you were hurt by the church, my heart breaks for you. I talk to people all the time that says that. And the first thing that we want to do, not only on Faith on Altar, but on Real Seekers, is to not be offensive, to not hurt your feelings or anything like that. And I hope we don't do that. Or haven't yet. It sounds like we're having a really good conversation. But we want to accurately represent Jesus in the way in which he was, or we believe he was, or he manifested himself. And so that is with love, that is with compassion, that is with charity. And so my heart breaks whenever I hear that. I hear too many people saying that. The second thing I just want to comment on real quick is that I resonate so well with you whenever I hear you say things like, make the world a better place. That intuition, what you were talking about, I think everybody has the intuition that there is something wrong with this world and that it wasn't the way maybe it was meant to be, the way Dell and I would describe it. And so I really resonate. I thought, I'm not gonna lie, I honestly thought we would have nothing in common, not even gonna lie, before you came on. Now though, hearing you say stuff like that, it resonates with me because I do believe there's something wrong in the world. I believe that's sin. And I believe that Jesus came to do away with that. And so I appreciate you. And I just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
See, this is now, why I bring Tyler on. He's got a way with words. I don't know.
Well, I'm just, this is all off the top. Like, I don't have any of this wrote down. So yeah, that's my heart. I'm trying to express my heart to you, Barbara, on that. Now, I disagree with some of the things that you've said, obviously, but I love you and I appreciate you coming on and having this conversation with us. So I really do. My follow-up before we go to question six, which I do want to go there. But I'm really curious about this. I was writing this down as you were talking to Dell. You've described God as compassion a few times in this interview. And I'm just curious, on your model, could the fullness of God, the fullness of deity, whatever that is, could that ever be described as a person on your view? What do you think about that?
You know, that's a good question. It's really mysterious to me that in this definition of God, and with my air quotes, it may not be yours, but compassion with a capital C, mm-hmm. not just the small compassion that where we love each other, but this incredible intelligence that uses the four fundamental forces to create the entire universe. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, what could that has to be God. It has to be God. And I heard something today that was really profound to me. And it's like when God wanted to create fish, he talked to the ocean. Mm. When God wanted to create a tree, he talked to the earth. When God wanted to create humans, he talked to himself. Mm. So if you take a fish out of the water, it's going to die. If you take a tree out of the ground, it's going to die. If you take us out of God, in our separation that our mind does, where we say we're not a part of God or there is no God or whatever, mm-hmm. we die. We literally die, and we get the world that we're seeing in where people are acting, they're making evil choices so readily, I think because they're disconnected from God or compassion, whatever that powerful source is. So is the compassion a human, or is that what the question was? Is it a human? There has to be something. But then, you know, God also created trees. So is God a tree? You know, I love that mystery part of it.
Sure. Sure. No, I appreciate that. Dell, do you want me to go to question six, or do you want to ask that since I just asked a question?
Sure. Yeah. I'm fine. Whatever way I can ask question six. So I kind of wanted to approach. So with question six, I asked in question five, we kind of looked at skepticism from like the typical materialist or atheistic type perspective, you know, a scientist and that. But there are also skeptics on the religious variety as well, who will be skeptical of some of your claims. And on that front, obviously me and Tyler are Christians. And so I know that, for example, there are biblical reasons or reasons of divine revelation that would kind of speak against channeling the dead and stuff like that. And, you know, as Tyler kind of hinted above, we might attribute that kind of activity to demonic activity rather than speaking to dead spirits. So I just wanted to get your take on what are some of the objections or criticisms and feedback you've gotten from religious skeptics, and how have you reconciled that with your models and stuff?
I think the people who express that to me, in fact, someone just wrote the other day something very similar to that, like, you can't, it's evil, it's not right. And what I said was, you know, we're in this world, all of us together, and we all have our worldviews. And I cannot tell you that your worldview is wrong. I can disagree. I can say, in my experience, I don't have that experience of demons overtaking me. I think there's a lot of information in the work that I do that explains why that is. But that what's most important to me is love. And how am I going to love you with your different ideas? And how am I going to determine what, for example, right now I'm struggling with people who are denying how bad things are in the world. Mm-hmm. And I have to love them it doesn't mean I have to invite them into my house every day and listen to them tell me things that I know aren't true. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's really more important, is how are we each going to reconcile the many diverse viewpoints and religions that we have so that we can be unified. That's really what is more important to me than if my what I'm doing matches up completely with what you believe. Mm-hmm. And I, that person who said that, I said, I support your right to believe that. And mm-hmm. and to have that religion, that's what this country was built on, was us being able to be free. And but we've fallen into this thing where I'm right and you're wrong. And I don't think that's what Jesus was about. I think he was about love and compassion, and how do we forgive people? How do we forgive our enemies? How do we live together in that world?
Yeah, yes? Tyler, right? Move aside, Tyler. You can see right behind him. He's got his little "Love your enemies," right? That's
exactly that's Jesus'
commandments for a Christian. So, mm-hmm. I think well said. I mean, I do think that it's a lost art. We had this classical principle of toleration and tolerance, right? Where we can tolerate people who disagree with us and that sort of thing. And look, we're under a Christian worldview. We are all made in the image of God. We all are all human beings who should love each other and care about doing what's best for each other, even despite the fact that we disagree. That's why there's dialogue and debate and discussion. And, you know, we work together towards the truth. I think the only thing I would come back on is I do think Jesus, there is a truth and a falsity, right? Like maybe either one of us is wrong or perhaps both of us is wrong, but there is a truth. And I think that's part of toleration, right? That's why I bring on people who disagree with me and we consider each other's perspectives, why we believe what we believe, and try to get to the truth. But I do have an audience question that would be relevant here, but Tyler, do you have any follow-ups before I go to that? Or
the only follow-up I got is I resonated with Barbara so well whenever she was just describing that in my relationship with you, Dell. We fight like cats and dogs, but at the end of the day, we love each other. So, exactly. And I think we're good co-hosts together. So
that's because at the root mm-hmm. of who you are, mm-hmm. you have compassion.
That's right. That's right. That's right. There we go. Love your neighbor as yourself. I love it. Go ahead, Dill.
So this one's from Harry Stark, and it's on this notion about, you know, compassion as this fifth principle, God as compassion. And he's saying he thinks Barbara is wrong about compassion being compatible with all religions, because some religions, such as Hinduism, they teach systematic discrimination through the caste system, or in Islam, it teaches to murder infidels or apostates. So, can you really synthesize all the religions to be compatible with this compassion principle?
I think I said all good religions. I'm talking about the religions that are truly based in compassion. And Hinduism, and see, I don't know enough about Hinduism and Islam to really comment, but I know enough about Christianity to know that if you want to take Christianity and twist it into a really crappy religion, you can. You can find places in the Bible that say you have to kill the gay people. Or I mean, I'm just from my, again, I didn't study the Bible. My associate, Kimberly, wrote a book called Second Coming, Awakening the Christ Within, and she knows the Bible inside out. And there you can twist it any way that you want, but it's what's in your heart as the one who is practicing the religion that forms if that religion is going to be, like you said, like Harry says. I happen to think that Christianity is based in compassion from what I know, but the Christians who I grew up with didn't practice it that way. So right. it's a good question, and it's worth exploring.
Gotcha. All right, cool. Tyler, any follow-ups from you? Because I know you already kind of asked question 7 to Barbara, but yeah, do you have any follow-ups, or based on her answer to 7, did you have anything you wanted to probe a little more?
I don't
you've covered it.
No, I don't. I don't think I have any follow-ups or probing questions. I would like to ask before we get to question eight, though. And I'm going to ask this question, I promise. I just don't know if I want to do it now or at the end. But since I'm stalling, I'll just go ahead and do it now. Barbara, what is your game plan if the view that you're advocating for, so on a scientific level now, so I know we're bouncing kind of back and forth between science and religion, but what's your game plan if the view you're advocating for on a scientific level is ultimately rejected by the scientific community? Do you have a backup plan, or is this what you're going to continue to do and advocate for?
I'm going to be informed by the scientific community, because as all science is, it's ever changing. But because it's rooted in compassion, to me, it is that, where it goes back to this question about science philosophy, is that there's a reason why it was delivered in a far more philosophical vein, and why I can say, okay, maybe this isn't Einstein, but let's talk about this information, and let's have it inform each other. Mm. And that conflict revolution, the process that I teach, it doesn't need a scientific confirmation for it to have its miraculous outcomes. Mm-hmm. So I will continue to teach conflict revolution.
Right on.
All right, cool. So yeah, the last question that I have on the list, I think this is one of the most important ones for me and Tyler. But so you mentioned in terms of your own worldview, it's not your job to convince or provide proofs or reasons or evidences for it, kind of thing. I'm just kind of curious, on our end with Christianity, I'm not sure, are you aware, like Christian apologetics, they have tried to provide certain reasons to support the Christian worldview. You know, so for example, there's the historical argument for the resurrection from people like Gary Habermas or that sort of thing, or for myself, I'm a well-known proponent of the evidence from the Shroud of Turin, for example. So I just wanted to turn it to you. Like, are you familiar at all with Christian apologetics and some of the evidences they've given to kind of support the Christian worldview at all? Or
I'm not familiar with what that means, the apologetics.
Okay.
Are
just
they
means a defense type thing?
A what?
It just means like a defense, like you're giving evidence. Yeah.
No, but I know enough about the Bible, having for the years that I was in church, and then my friend Kim, who has totally created this absolute curiosity that I now have with the Bible, because so much of what is in the Bible, as she's interpreting it, is on my maps. So I love the whole idea that, and talking about the Shroud of Turin, right? The story, the resurrection, that to me makes perfect sense. It's not like some mystery, just theoretical thing. I think Jesus, and he's in also Party of 12, so I've channeled him. And I think you would probably see a lot of what's you agree with in that interview as well. But I think that Christianity channeled compassionately is brilliant. And he came to tell us there's an afterlife. He came to show us you don't die. Here we are. He wasn't the only one. These things that I do, I'm coming here to tell you, you too can do. So that really supports what I'm saying about we have the power to align to God and make decisions for the good of the whole, starting with taking care of ourselves as a operating system. And that's what those of us in, I don't know what you'd call me. I'm not like a New Ager, and I'm not like a metaphysicist. I don't know what I am. But we are here to bring this new earth so that we can transcend this evil that we're talking about and become that change of rooting ourselves in compassion so the world can go on. And to me, that Christianity and the Bible and those lessons, are brilliant. It's just brilliant.
So that's great. I think I heard you say you are open to the fact that Jesus was risen bodily from the dead.
Absolutely. I mean, and he says that in the interview too, and he talks about the fact that, you know, he was dealing with this time period, right? In the time that he walked the earth, there was a particular, there was not psychology, right? There was a much, much different way that he had to communicate with people, knowing that he knew that 2,000 years later, or whatever, the second coming, being that Christ is waking up within us and we are becoming, Jesus is our role model, but we want to become like him. And he had to do it in a way that would sustain through time. And yet those initial apostles and the women, right? The women's core had to be able to process it. I know what it's like in my life to process that. I've been talking to Einstein. It took me years of really, this is just crazy. Imagine what they were. Here he is. So it's all just so brilliant. I just think it's brilliant.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I think the moral influence view, right? Like God, Jesus is our representative. As Tyler, no, as an Orthodox, Tyler goes more into this, even more into this than I do, but we are called to be sanctified and become more and more like Christ. He is our moral exemplar, so to speak. And beyond that, the death on the cross, if you're believing he truly died and rose from the dead for our sins, that is an amazing belief, because he loved us so much. He had mercy and compassion on us that he died for our sins, for our wrongs. Here, yeah, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. So like, that's an amazing message and stuff. So yeah, I'm grateful that you're willing to consider the evidence for the resurrection and how that relates to Jesus, the claims of Christianity in terms of the essential beliefs. But
oh, absolutely. And one of the things he says in the book is about the crucifixion, is that, you know, he came here such a perfect being. He came here whole, ready to do whatever, you know, his mission, however that came about, etc., the Son of God. And throughout his life, he was Jesus the man and Jesus God. So he was the son of God, but he was also human in that sense. Yep. Yep. But he had this extraordinary unified field, so he didn't suffer like we suffer in that sense. So when he was crucified, that was the way when, you know, he suffered, but not in the way that we did, but by feeling all of that pain that was the humanity's pain, he took that on and he transmogrified it, transcended it to show us. And that, again, brilliant. You'd think I was a Christian.
All right. Yeah, Tyler, anything on this? You know, Barbara is saying she accepts the resurrection as a fact, which is a leg up on many of the others that we've spoken to and stuff. So yeah, anything, yeah. Any follow-up questions or comments?
So it might sound weird to our audience that I'm going about what I'm getting ready to say, but Barbara, and please don't take this facetious. Like I promise I'm genuinely curious about what I'm getting ready to ask you. So you're not the first person to come on our show claiming that they've talked to Jesus. Here's the difficulty I have. Okay. Is that what you're saying is completely contradictory to what they said. Now I'm not saying who's wrong or right or anything like that.
They who though?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
They who?
You want a specific name? Sean Griffin. We interviewed, if you can look it up on the Faith Unaltered channel.
Oh, okay.
We interviewed Sean Griffin that claims to speak to God the Father, claims to speak to Jesus. And his message is, like I said, contradictory to yours. And so my question is, how do I or my audience practically, on a practical level, hearing both of these claims, how do we reconcile what's true, what's false? What would you say to if somebody asked you that?
I would say that nobody owns Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that I personally feel that Jesus came here to have a personal relationship with you. Mm-hmm. And you should be able to talk to Jesus if you have a personal relationship with him, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not supposed to be going through the priests. I mean, there's certainly people who are trained to help guide us, but ultimately our relationship is me and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why they call it come to Jesus, because when you come to Jesus and have a meeting, that is the most profound communication I think that you can have with Jesus. So who am I to say that you can or can't? Mm-hmm. I happen to believe that all of us are supposed to be talking to Jesus more one-on-one.
Sure.
So, but if he talks to God, but you can't talk to God, is that what he's saying?
No. No, the messages that you guys are describing, both claiming to talk to Jesus specifically, are contradictory. And that's what I was getting at. How do I figure out who's telling the truth or not? So
yeah. Your own relationship to him.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Dale? So I'm looking at the audience questions. I think Barbara's answered it for the most part, but there is something that I can glean here that might be a little bit different. So Harry Stark, you don't have to read everything here, but he ends with this, you know, obviously, Barbara, you're willing to accept the bodily resurrection. And what I wanted to probe about, it sounded like you were accepting the incarnation, that Jesus is God in some way as well, which is a major thing, right? Like, did I get that right? Or do you accept that Jesus was also God? Or?
Well, but I think we all are. That's what he came here to teach us. He was just more evolved in to be that example to show us how we develop in that way.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm glad I clarified that. So Harry Stark asked this kind of question, like, if you're willing to grant quite a lot, not, I wouldn't say all of the essential Christian beliefs, like what is it that's preventing you from accepting, from being a full-on Christian and accepting Christianity as the correct worldview with a capital V kind of thing?
I think because it's not, it doesn't, the depth of the focus and the commitment of the structure of Christianity doesn't encompass enough for me. I get that it's all knowing, all encompassing for you, and I support that, but I have so many other worldviews and so many other curiosities and things that I believe that don't fall within Christianity that, and plus there's something about having anything be my Lord, if you want to define what Lord is, it may be part of why I left Christianity in the first place, because there's a hierarchy and there's a patriarchy within the structure of how Christianity operates that, like I said, can be good or it can be not so good, depending on who's the one who's practicing the Christianity as I was inflicted upon when I was young. So I think I have to be able to find that compassion, that commitment to being and embodying all that without having to structure myself into that kind of belief system.
Gotcha. So it's kind of a lot of people, I think it's kind of like the institution of the church, the hierarchy or like the patriarchy, as some have said and stuff. Obviously Tyler and I are going to disagree with that ourselves. Like Protestant, I think the Bible represents the true faith kind of thing. You know, I don't have any man-made traditions or stuff like that. Tyler takes an opposite view on that front, and he thinks that the traditions are infallible and inspired as well. So I think there's differences on that front, but yeah, it's good to know like what is, because you do accept certain things, what is preventing you and stuff. So thank you for answering that. And Tyler, do you have anything you want to say on this end?
Not right at this moment. I know that we asked the last question, Dale, but before we get off here, I know, because I'm hard I got a hard stop at an hour and a half. I promised my wife I wouldn't do multiple shows this week, and here I am doing multiple shows this week. And so
God bless her.
Yeah, yeah, for please. Amen. But no, I've got closing remarks, but no, I don't think I have any other questions for Barbara. Thank you, Barbara, for answering and being upfront with us. We really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
All right, cool. So I'll go to closing remarks then. And yeah, I'll Tyler, I'll start with you. I'll give the guest the last word. So,
okay, yeah, fair enough. So before we get, I guess before I say in comments about anything show-wise specifically, there was a Facebook comment that was made that I feel like I have to address, not about this show. So this was about me specifically. And bringing on guests who, because we are streaming both to Real Seekers, which is Dell's channel, and Faith Unaltered, which is mine and David Russell's channel. But about bringing on people of ultimate, that we ultimately would disagree with in the end, and making it somehow like we are involved in spreading quote-unquote lies, spreading falsehoods, and this, that, and the other. And first of all, for someone to make that comment, they don't understand the premise of my show. My show is to get people together. One of the reasons is to get people together who disagree about certain things. We've had atheists on. We've had New Age people on before. We've had the entire spectrum of religion and secular. We also deal with philosophical issues as well. And so I will never, and I couldn't anyway, turn my channel, our channel, into an Eastern Orthodox only channel or a Protestant only or Roman Catholic only. And I don't think that that'd be very fun anyway. I know echo chambers exist on the web, and I don't want Faith Unaltered to be an echo chamber. I'm sick of it. I value people's opinions, especially those who disagree with me. And people that disagree with me are more than welcome on my channel anytime. So before I even started on that, I wanted to say this, and we welcome everyone that would like to come on. And if you are watching this and you don't think something that somebody said, whether it's Barbara, whether it's any guest that we have on, Warren McGrew is a well-hated fellow on the interwebs by some. If you don't like what they say, well, come on with us and explain to us why. Simple. So with that being said, I wanted to say, Barbara, I appreciate you coming on. I do disagree. I don't think I have to keep saying that. I think people get that, right? But at the same time, I respect, and like I said, I can resonate with a lot of the things that you did say. And so we have common ground, and I'm happy with that. You're more than welcome back on my channel anytime. And I would love to dive into some of the things, biblical, with your, who did you say she was, like a partner,
Kimberly Phelps, Second yes. Coming, Awakening the Christ Within.
I would love to read the book and interview her specifically.
You should. She's fabulous. You'll love her.
That'd be an interesting conversation. But with that being said, Dale, did you want to say something real quick? Sorry, I thought I heard you.
I was just saying awesome. Good.
Yeah, that'd be great. So if you could set us up after that, that'd be awesome. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that Faith Unaltered is supposed to be and has been designed, and I hope we are being, a place where we can provide clarity amongst a various amount of different topics, Christian or not, with charity. And I hope we've done that, Barbara, for you. And if we hadn't, then I'm sorry and I apologize, and we'll definitely try harder next time. But I don't sense that. And so with that being said, I appreciate you coming on, and thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So yeah, with that said, my closing words, Tyler basically took the words out of my mouth. I hope that, in coming to dialogue, we've learned some things from you and that can help us in our faith. And I hope we've given you something to think about on your end as well, in terms of our Christian faiths. But Barbara, I want to give you the last word. You are the guest. So over to you for the closing word there.
Well, thank you, Dale. And I would just say that amongst everything that we can disagree with, we seek to find the things that we agree with. Not that we don't talk about what we disagree with, but in the end, if what we're going to do is be Christ-like and we're going to bring the world together and we're going to be compassion, then our responsibility is to make sure that we are living up to those compassionate values, whether it's your religion or your religion or my philosophy. And I think that's what the world needs right now. I just saw an interview with Tucker Carlson and Chris Cuomo, and talk about two diverging views. But they showed us how to talk together and leave connected like we're supposed to, because that's who we are. We are compassion. We are God. We are one. We are here to love each other. And however you do that, I'm just fine with however you get to that end result.
All right. Awesome. Well, I think that does it for today's show. So I just want to say thanks again to both Tyler and Barbara for joining me to do this show. And I look forward to doing future shows with your friend as well and stuff like that. So,
and thanks to your audience too. Great questions. Happy to answer.
Awesome. Yep. They always do a good job. So, all right, cool. Well, with that said, next week I will be bringing on Dr. David Kemble Cook, who again, disagrees with us. He was a former Christian. He's left the faith, and we've been kind of going back and forth, on his reasons for leaving the faith. So look out for that next week. It'll be a little bit of a math lesson on Bayes' theorem, but the other part is we're going to get into the historical evidence for the resurrection and how do we prove that Jesus rose from the dead, because he doesn't believe that. So yeah, that said, have a great week and take care, everybody.
Thank you.
All right, I've hit the red button.